Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the FBI says Hillary Clinton shouldn't face federal charges for using her personal email while she was Secretary of State. We'll get local reaction to that. Plus, remembering Holocaust survivor, author, and BU professor Elie Wiesel, who died this past weekend at 87.
I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The good news for Hillary Clinton is that the FBI will not recommend that criminal charges be filed against her. That's the conclusion of a nearly year-long investigation into her use of a personal email server to handle sensitive information while she was Secretary of State. Here's FBI Director James Comey speaking earlier today.
Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case.
Comey's announcement lifts a huge legal burden from Clinton as she prepares to accept the Democratic presidential nomination in Philadelphia at the end of this month. One can imagine a big sigh of relief from the Clinton presidential campaign. On the other hand, the FBI findings will do little to convince Clinton's opponents that she should be trusted with the nation's highest office. Because Director Comey also said Clinton should have known that using a personal email server could have jeopardized national security.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
Joining us now is Donald Stern. He's the former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts and now a Boston-based attorney with Affiliated Monitors Incorporated. And Donald Stern, welcome. It's always good to have you on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Anthony.
So it sounds like this came down to intent, that the FBI found that Clinton and her staff might have goofed and even goofed badly, but didn't find evidence that they deliberately broke the law. Is that your reading of this?
Yeah, I think probably the heart of the investigation, which according to the director, ended up being more complicated from a computer forensic point of view than I think us on the outside thought was going on, really focused on intent. And to do that, they obviously look for any direct evidence whether Secretary Clinton intended to violate the law, either a felony or a misdemeanor, but also look at the circumstances surrounding the use of the private server. And, you know, they did that both by the computer forensic analysis as well as by interviewing apparently a lot of people.
So I'm having trouble, though, with this understanding this idea of intent, because what about the idea that we all sort of grow up hearing, and that is that ignorance of the law doesn't necessarily give you a free pass if you break the law? Because, it sounds like whether she meant to or not, I mean, there were more than 100 emails contained information already classified at the time as being top secret or special access only, and yet charges aren't filed. I'm just curious how that works.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are some laws, you know, such as robbing a bank or something like that, where, you know, you could prove, if you will, general intent. You don't have to show that the person knew that it was a federally insured bank and that money was kept in the bank and that you were violating the law by going in and handing the teller a note and asking for the money with a weapon by your side. It's assumed that if you can just show the general intent to commit that crime, that you violated the law. There are other statutes, other violations, which are more akin to specific intent. So you've got to show that you knew, for example, that certain information either was or was likely to be classified, that you knew that what you're doing was in violation of the law. So, there's always a gradation between those crimes for which no intent is even required, strict liability offenses, for example, and those like this one where you really have to show more and the burden is higher for the government to show not only that the law was violated, but that you had some intent, you had some knowledge that was willful that you violated the law.
I see. Now, after FBI Director Comey made the point that usually investigators would hand over what they found to the prosecutors and let the prosecutors decide how to move forward, but today he actually issued a recommendation publicly that no reasonable prosecutor would bring a case over this kind of thing. How unusual is it for the head of the FBI to make this kind of recommendation?
Well, I think it's not unusual that the FBI would make a recommendation. There are three things that the director did that were quite unusual. The first two I'll describe make sense to me, and I think I understand them. The third, I have some real problems with. The first is that, as you point out, the FBI made this announcement, that they signaled in a public way what their recommendation was going to be to the Department of Justice. That's quite unusual. These are discussions that take place basically in conference rooms, and ultimately it's the Department of Justice that makes the determination and makes the public announcement. Yeah, I think he did that because of, the Attorney General had already announced that she would rely upon the FBI's recommendation, and because of the very public nature of the investigation. The second thing he did was he described in detail the investigation and what they found. And as Director Comey said, this was unusual transparency. Mm-hmm. That's not something, particularly where an indictment is not brought, that either the Department of Justice or the FBI would do. Often when there's an announcement of a charge, the charging documents, the indictment, for example, would lay out some of the specifics. It's quite unusual that where you don't indict, that you would lay out that kind of detail. The third thing he did, and this may sound counterintuitive, but I think to some extent the fact that this was in the midst of a political environment actually hurt Secretary Clinton in terms of this last thing, which is Director Comey then went beyond the contours of saying a crime has been committed or hasn't been committed, and here's what the FBI is recommending. He went on to essentially make some personal comments about her carelessness and her judgment, and, if you will, the culture of the State Department in handling confidential and classified information. That also is unusual. Mm.
And you say you have a problem with that because, I mean, that goes beyond the normal sort of purview of the FBI director in this context?
Yeah, I can't think of another instance. Maybe they're there sometimes, perhaps in civil rights investigations where the Department of Justice would, for example, say, well, we're not going to bring a charge against this police department or this police officer, but here are some problems with what happened. And that's pretty much what Director Comey did here. That would not be normally done. I understand why he did it. I think it was intended to show the kind of even-handedness and thoroughness and independence of his judgment and the FBI judgment. My point is that's outside the norm, and that would not typically be the case.
All right. Well, that's Donald Stern. He's a former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, now a Boston-based attorney with Affiliated Monitors Incorporated in Boston. Donald Stern, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Anthony.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about how this will play out on the campaign trail. We're joined now by Annie Linsky. She's a national political reporter for the Boston Globe and joins us from Washington, D.C. And Annie, good to have you.
Hi, good to be here.
So on the one hand, I can imagine big sighs of relief from the Clinton campaign. On the other hand, as we were just talking about with Donald Stern, a pretty tough rebuke from FBI Director Comey. How do you think this plays out? I mean, is this advantage Clinton at this point, or what's your view on this?
Well, I think that I have to start off by saying, Clinton clearly avoided the Category 5 hurricane that would have been unleashed had the finding been the opposite, that charges should be filed. I spend a lot of time talking to folks in Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn, and they have always said that in all the various lawsuits, and there are many that swirl around Clinton's time at the State Department, the piece that they are most concerned about and have been most concerned about is this Department of Justice or this FBI investigation. So I think it's clearly an enormous relief. That said, my goodness, watching the 15-minute sort of rant and diatribe from Director Comey was really stunning. I mean, you could almost see that thing being played in its entirety in the opening of the Republican convention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of attack ad material in there, in other words.
And from so many different fronts. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's been the most interesting to think about is, you know, he opened up a number of lines of attack. I mean, from one perspective, he's pointing out that, look, her system could have been hacked. He raises that possibility, really kind of laying out a way in which it could have happened and the FBI wouldn't have known. He attacks the talking points that Clinton has been using over and over again, really for the last year. She said the same things. She didn't send or receive classified information. He points out that clearly she should have known that some of those emails were top secret. And then, you know, another talking point that she has deployed, you know, again and again is this idea that she turned over all of her work-related emails. Well, the FBI found that wasn't true. Hmm. There were work-related emails she didn't turn over. So it just reopens all of those questions, and it begins to underline this idea that she's been struggling with for the last year of trustworthiness. And that's what really that 15-minute press conference, I think, is going to underline for some voters.
That's really interesting because, as you suggested, the polling shows again and again that if Clinton has an Achilles heel, it's this issue about trust. And you're mm-hmm. suggesting this isn't going to help isn't going to help her on that score.
Well, he goes out of his way at one point in the press conference to sort of underline a related weakness that she has, that she's playing by a different set of rules. And he says, you know, towards the very end, look, we're not recommending charges here, but don't think that somebody else wouldn't get away with this because, hey, look, you know, what we saw here was pretty bad, and, you know, nobody should see this as a unpunishable error.
Yeah.
So, you know, over and over again, you know, the Republicans, of course, would have wanted to see an indictment, but, you know, short of that, they certainly got a 15-minute attack ad that we'll hear.
Well, I noticed that Brian Fallon, the Clinton campaign yeah. spokesperson, he put out a message on Twitter that said, "We are glad this matter is mm-hmm. now resolved," among other things he said. But does it seem resolved to you at this point, or
I think that is wishful thinking on
yeah.
his part. You know, from a legal perspective, of course, yes, it is resolved. Of course, Attorney General Loretta Lynch still needs to weigh in and make the final call, but she has already said she would not contradict what the FBI recommended, so that would be unlikely. But no, I think this is really just the beginning of a new phase where we're going to be hearing over and over the words that he used, that she was extremely careless with classified information. And I think, you know, your listeners are going to get sick of those two words because they're going to be replayed, you know, over and over and over and over again.
On the other hand, it'll be interesting to see how Donald Trump handles this because he's been tweeting. I mean, he started tweeting immediately. I mean, here's one of his tweets. FBI director and crooked Hillary compromised our national security. No charges. Wow. Hashtag rigged system. You know, you just wonder how his reaction is going to, I don't know, resonate with voters, if it's going to sound...
His reaction, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
His reaction was very... You know, I my first instinct when I saw his reaction was to think, oh my goodness, why is he attacking the FBI with that kind of language? You know, you would think that he would train his attack on the person he's running against, Hillary Clinton. But when you think about it, his response is actually very carefully crafted. He is running against the system, and Hillary Clinton represents the system. This is the case that he's trying to build. So he's saying, in essence, that the FBI, this result is just part of this overall rigged system that a vote for me will sweep away. And to the extent that Donald Trump can turn this election into an outsider versus an insider election, you know, those moments are moments in which he is winning. When the election becomes about one of his many, many surprising and offensive statements, then Hillary Clinton is winning. So you saw other Republicans actually echo the same kind of language that Donald Trump used, which is a shift. In the past, Trump has kind of gone off and said something, and the Republicans have thought, oh gosh, mostly distanced themselves. But you saw Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House, made a very similar statement, kind of attacking the FBI. Gerald Issa in the U.S. House of Representatives, a Republican leader, using the same kind of language. So they really are trying to make it insider versus outsider.
Interesting. Well, that's Annie Linsky. She's a national political reporter for the Boston Globe. Annie, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
And listeners, we've got more ahead. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to remember Elie Wiesel, who died over the weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We want to take some time now to remember Elie Wiesel, who died this past weekend at the age of 87. Wiesel survived Nazi concentration camps and became an eloquent witness to the horrors of the Holocaust. His mother, father, and younger sister were among the 6 million Jews who perished in Europe. He was a prolific writer of plays, essays, memoirs, dozens of books, including his autobiography, Night, which recounted, among other things, the journey that his family took in a cramped, airless cattle car to a place called Auschwitz. In that book, he wrote, "Never shall I forget that night." And in the decades that followed, he implored the world never to forget. Here's Elie Wiesel in 1986 accepting the Nobel Peace Prize.
The world did know and remained silent. And that is why I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must speak. We must take sides.
For nearly 40 years, Elie Wiesel was a charismatic lecturer and humanities professor right here at Boston University. And joining us now to remember him and his legacy is Rabbi Joseph Pollack. He was a close friend of Elie Wiesel's. He, too, is a Holocaust survivor. He's also a rabbi emeritus of the Hillel House at Boston University and author of After the Holocaust, The Bells Still Ring. And Rabbi Pollack, thank you for coming in. I'm very grateful.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is Susanna Heschel. She's a professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College. And Professor Heschel, good to have you on Radio Boston as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. What are your memories of Elie Wiesel? What does his legacy mean to you? What questions do you have about his life? These are two people who knew an awful lot about him. They knew him personally. You can give us a call. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I wanted to ask you both, Susanna Heschel and Rabbi Pollack, for some sort of personal memories. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about the sort of public legacy, but let's start with something more personal. And I'll start with you, Rabbi Pollack. You knew him. How are you remembering him as a person?
I remember him both in his public persona. I remember him in his private persona. We used to study together every week. An hour, half hour, depending on what he was available for. And we studied classical Jewish texts together. So when we studied together, he would have a way of diving into the text and reading them at such rapid fire speed that I would say to him, "Elie, you can't possibly understand what you're saying. Slow down." And he would smile. And I know that the smile was that he was taken back to his childhood, that he must have been accused of the same things. He did have a very fast mind, and he did sink into those texts with an awful quick rapidity, and then he would remember what we had studied for years, and he would bring it back to me from time to time. So, his great articulation, his great gift with words notwithstanding, he had a marvelous mind and an excited mind, and he was always going intellectually 90 miles an hour.
And Professor Heschel, I'd like to ask the same question to you, a sort of personal memory of Elie Wiesel.
I came to know Elie Wiesel when I was a little girl. We lived on Riverside Drive in New York City. My father was a professor of Jewish theology at the Jewish Theological Seminary. He was Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. I don't know how they first met, but every Shabbat afternoon, Elie Wiesel would come to our home around 4 o'clock, and he and my father would go for a walk and talk at Riverside Park for a half hour, an hour, and then they would come upstairs and have tea. And so those are my earliest memories. At the time, Elie was unknown in the United States or in the world. He had, though, a look about him of someone who had just come from hell. You could see immediately. And gradually over the years, he and my father would talk about various issues. My father was very engaged with the effort to free Jews in the Soviet Union who were not allowed to practice Judaism. My father gave a public lecture about that that was not well received by Jews because they felt that we should be quiet and handle such matters quietly, privately. But my father asked Elie to go to the Soviet Union. Elie was at the time working as a journalist, and he went, and he came back, and he wrote a book called The Jews of Silence. It's a wonderful book. And it was gradually over the years people started to read Elie's work. But really, I think not until the 1970s did he become an important voice in the United States and around the world.
Well, I want to talk about that important voice and the legacy, his legacy, and really what he spent his life dedicated to. And it seems that more than anything, it was speaking out against forgetfulness. So here's a bit more from his Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 1986, where he talks about this idea of forgetfulness.
If we forget, we are guilty. We are accomplices. We could not prevent their death the first time. But if we forget them, they will be killed the second time. And this time, it will be our responsibility.
So, Rabbi Pollack, can you talk a little bit about this idea of forgetfulness and how it defines so much of his work?
It's a very fine question. The Jewish people in antiquity had an institution in the form was usually women. They were called mitonanim, and their task was to come to, I guess, the home of the mourner or to the cemetery during the funeral and really whip up a frenzy. They knew how to mourn. And I don't think the world then in what, the 50s, the 60s, certainly even the Jews knew how to mourn. Not for this level of loss. And he unconsciously, this is not his intention, but he unconsciously picked up this role. The word mitonanim, I just checked, is not in modern Hebrew dictionaries, but it is in the classical Jewish texts. And he picked up this role and was able to help the Jewish community in general and the world at large witness the Yad Vashem and witness the Holocaust Museum in Washington. He was able to teach people how to open themselves up to the unlimited limits of this tragedy. I also like to add something to what Professor Heschel said, if I may. She is, of course, correct in saying that there was no real worldwide action about the Holocaust in terms of feeling, in terms of literature, in terms of anything, until the 70s. And I spoke once to Raoul Hilberg about this. Hilberg was probably the preeminent historian of the Holocaust at the University of Vermont and perhaps in the world. And I said, how come no one opened their mind? His book was published in 61. Elie Wiesel's book around the same time. Elie sold about 1,000 copies. His books probably sold less. And I said, how come no one picked up it until the 70s? He said that no one picked up on this criticizing Germany and criticizing the world for what had happened until we learned to criticize governments. And we didn't learn to criticize governments until Vietnam.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Susan Heschel, I wanted to just read just some words out of this book, Night, because it sticks with this idea of forgetfulness. Never shall I forget that night, that first night in the camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. It goes on, never shall I forget that smoke, never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath a silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever. And this leads to a question that I would like to ask both of you, because he raised these questions that are so difficult to answer. He was a man of faith who essentially asked, you know, how could such horrors exist in a world where a just God exists, and how we live in a universe that tolerates such cruelty. Did he offer answers to these questions, Professor Heschel?
First of all, I think that remembering is quintessentially a religious deed to remember, and that's what we do when we pray, for example. But I think that raising the questions that he did is also very Jewish, as he, as Elie Wiesel himself pointed out. But the other issue that he did raise was how do we continue as Jews, as human beings? And yet he did. He remained an observant Jew all his life. I think on the other side, we might ask, as he did, of course, why were so many silent? Why did so many participate? Why were there Catholic priests and Protestant pastors mm-hmm. who came to death camps and offered mass for the SS officers who were murdering people? We might also ask, and my father raised this question, how does God keep faith in us after we behave in such a way? My father used to say, what we need to do is perhaps say Kaddish for our souls, because we lost all sense of human responsibility. My father said the opposite of good is not evil. The opposite of good is indifference. And Elie Wiesel, of course, agreed with him on that and spoke often of the danger of indifference.
Listeners, we're talking about Elie Wiesel, who passed away this past Saturday at the age of 77. I'm joined by Professor of Jewish Studies at Dartmouth. 87. I'm so sorry. 87. I misspoke there. That's Rabbi Joseph Pollack of Boston University is with me here in the studio, and Professor Susanna Herschel of Dartmouth College. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255 if you have questions or comments. And let's go to Dave, who's calling from Needham. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. And Rabbi Pollack, although this is an anonymous call-in show, I want to greet you anonymously. I've had several meetings with you and always been impressed. President Obama has praised Elie Wiesel upon his death as the conscience of the world, I believe, was the wording. I have it in front of me. And the problem with that is that he's not Barack Obama's conscience, because Obama went for this agreement to give a genocidal regime like Iran genocidal weapons. He's not Hillary Clinton's conscience because Hillary Clinton supported that same agreement. Donald Trump's conscience, because Mr. Wiesel would probably be outraged at some of the appeals to racism and our lowest instincts that Trump has appealed to in this campaign.
Right. So you're saying not enough of Elie Wiesel in the sort of political consciousness in this world today, Dave, it sounds like you're saying. What do you think, Rabbi Pollack? Do you want to respond to Dave?
Well, I think that, what Dave is really asking us is who would Elie have voted for? And, if you asked him, he wouldn't tell you. But I think that none of those, not Obama and not Secretary Clinton, would budge on matters of deep moral conscience, I think, without consulting his mindset, if not him directly. And they don't always listen. They can't always listen. They have 1,000 different priorities, and I don't, of course, support the stuff on Iran that they have proposed. Yet at the same time, one has to understand the complexities of those things. And I think Elie is a figure that they each feel that they have to come to terms with whether or not they can do it to the full extent that he would want.
All right, let's take another call. Let's go to Woofer, who's calling from Lowell. Woofer, am I pronouncing that name correctly, first of all? And thanks for your call.
Yeah, it's Zuffer, but thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to speak in regards to the legacy of Mr. Wiesel. So I know he has this kind of, you know, reputation as a humanitarian. I just think that something like that should be called into question when, you know, Mr. Wiesel, you know, apologizes for the atrocities that happened in Gaza, you know, like children being massacred as they sleep. Same with Sabra and Shatila. He didn't really, he refused to condemn that, the horrific, you know, things that happened on that night. So I just think it's a little problematic to remember him as a universal humanitarian when he, you know, didn't really stand up for the rights of Palestinians, which have been horribly abused for the past 5 decades.
All right, Woofer, let me put that to our guests. Professor Heschel, he did have his critics, and around this issue in particular, that Elie Wiesel spoke out very passionately against genocide and slaughter in places all over the world, but was less outspoken when it came to the occupation of what many regard as the occupation of Palestine. What do you say to folks like Woofer?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to make distinction here between genocide and war. And a conflict in, if we think about the Nazi Holocaust, did Jews in Germany have weapons and attack Germany? Of course not. Why would Germany want to kill all the Jews of Europe and the world? That's a very different phenomenon from a war that is, in fact, two-sided. And there, my understanding is that, first of all, Elie Wiesel did frequently speak out on certain issues, for instance, about the migrants from Africa who've fled the war zones in which they were living, and many have sought refuge in Israel, and Elie has supported them outspokenly. I think he has also been outspoken privately and, as we say, behind the scenes in political ways. I can tell you that he worked together with my father at times. I have a letter that they both signed to Prime Minister Golda Meir, objecting in a very gentle way to some of the policies of the State of Israel. I don't think Elie Wiesel ever objected. I think he sought, as he should, as a responsible person should, the right way to handle each particular situation, how to speak and to whom to speak, and how to preserve one's effectiveness.
Mm. Rabbi Pollack, yes, please.
I don't have much to add. I think that, the way our caller has described some of the situations in Gaza is not accurate, and nor does he describe the situation accurately. And if there were humanitarian issues that needed being outspoken about, Elie spoke about it. He spoke about them publicly, and sometimes he spoke about them privately. He had the ear of every major politician in the world, including Abbas.
Hmm. Can
I jump in for a moment?
Yes, go ahead, Professor.
And just say, you know, the family of Elie Wiesel is now sitting Shiva. That's a Jewish custom of staying at home and receiving visitors who come in and whose obligation is to speak of the person who is deceased, to speak well of that person with the family. And I would like to just, if I may, add one story.
Please.
About him that
yes,
I think
do.
Is very sweet. So one time I think I was 12 or 13, and my parents wanted to go somewhere on a Saturday night after the Sabbath, and I didn't want to. I wanted to stay home, and I wasn't quite old enough to stay home alone, and they didn't have a babysitter, so they insisted that I come. We rode down our elevator from the 8th floor to the ground floor, and the elevator opened, and there was Elie Wiesel, and he had come to visit a colleague of my father's, Professor Saul Lieberman, who lived on the 5th floor. And he saw my face. I was dejected, and he was so sweet, and he said, you know, very sympathetically, what can I do? You have to go with your parents, but let me get you a present. I'm going to Paris in a few days. What would you like me to bring you? And I said, oh, I would love a bottle of perfume. And in fact, I named it. It was Bologna perfume that one of my aunts used to wear. And a few weeks later, he came to visit my parents, and he brought me a sweet little bottle of Bologna perfume that I have to this day. And I thought it was wonderful of him, of Elie Wiesel, to keep me in mind and to bring me a present. that thoughtfulness and kindness is something I'll always remember about him.
Mm. Lovely story. Thank you for sharing that with us, Susanna Heschel. I really appreciate that. Let's go to at least a couple more calls. We'd like to get them in if time allows. Campbell is calling from Dover. Campbell, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure, good to have you.
I grew up in the 50s in Iowa. It was a Leave It to Beaver existence. I was not aware of harshness and cruelty in the world, and that lack of knowledge lasted well into my high school years when I finally learned about the Holocaust. And that caused a confusion, upset, and depression in me that was very substantial, and I didn't quite know what to do with it. It was combined with family travel to Germany, where the questions only became even larger and more upsetting. And only when I became aware of Mr. Wiesel and the incredible work that he was doing to try to bring justice back into humanity. Excuse me.
Are you still with us? Are you still with us, Campbell?
Yeah. Excuse me, I just lost it for a minute.
No, I understand. It's an emotional issue for a lot of people, of course.
It brought a level of hope to me, which I have managed to maintain in trying to move forward to make the world a better place. And it really came from him. It was that hope that he brought back into my life and is a shining example through his life.
Well, Campbell, thanks so much for that incredibly heartfelt comment about Elie Wiesel. Rabbi Pollack, I'd love you to sort of get you to respond to that. I mean, you saw him up close for four decades here. I mean, what did it mean to have him on this campus, and in particular to the Jewish community here in Boston?
He was a man that radiated life and radiated good spirits, radiated a real capacity to enjoy himself. He spoke, you know, three times a year at those wonderful public lectures, where every time he spoke, 1,200 people showed up. And then after the second lecture, usually, when he was done at about 8:15, he would come to the Hillel House and there answer questions. He wouldn't give a talk again. He'd just answer questions from any student who happened to be there. And, of course, we used to pack the place every time he came. And the extent to which his for lack of a better word, handlers, kept winking at me, let the guy go home and go to sleep. He didn't want to leave. He had the best time. He loved interacting with students, listening to their questions, in the later years posing for selfies with them. He had the greatest pleasure and the best time of that. And what I'm trying to say is that his impression, in the last 3 days since he died, I have received probably scores of emails from alumni who were present for those sessions, who remembered not the man with the sad eyes and the searing voice about memory and the Holocaust, but the loving teacher, lover of students, lover of knowledge, lover of giving things over, as the Yiddish expressions goes. That's also really what stands out for me in my mind as I think back to those years.
Let's take a couple more calls.
Can I just say, that's so wonderful.
Please, Susanna Heschel. Yes.
What Rabbi Pollack said is wonderful. And I think it's also important for us to remember that Elie Wiesel wrote so many books and gave so many talks about biblical figures and rabbinic literature, about Hasidism, the pietistic movement, and Hasidic rebbes. He brought Judaism alive for so many people. And I also find that my students who read his work are so grateful, deeply grateful. So his legacy is enormous. He really represented Judaism in his day and inspired people, so many. I cannot imagine where we would be without him.
Let's go to Joan, who's calling from Brighton. Hi, Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony, and hello, Professor, and hello, Rabbi. A long time ago, when Elie Wiesel was doing those lectures, and we were showing up as part of the 1,200 and not wanting to leave, a much more friend of mine, that being observant, invited me to come along to the first one I went to, and it was unbelievably riveting. Now, I'm a 65-year-old woman. When I went, I was not a child and I was not a student, but I sat rapt for all of it. Now I'm going to cry. It was the most remarkable time every year, the most remarkable time I've ever had.
Well, Joan, thanks thanks for that. Susanna Heschel, I mean, we're getting comments from our listeners that really talk about the power that this man had when you saw him up close and personal, I guess.
Yes, and I'm sure people had the experience. They just looked at him, they met him, and they were transformed. There was something about him that he brought people to their own conscience. You couldn't look at him or experience a talk or read a book without all of a sudden thinking, who am I and what is my purpose? What is my responsibility in this life? He challenged people in a very deep way. And so I think President Obama is absolutely right. He was moral conscience. He brought each of us to our own conscience.
Listeners, we're talking about Elie Wiesel, who passed away this past Saturday at the age of 87. Let's get one more call. Peter is calling from Cambridge. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, mine's quite brief. It is remembering his book, Night in particular, because I had lost French family. But it also is in this country where we're hearing so many words used in such a unkind, miserable, thoughtless fashion. And Mr. Wiesel reminds us of the power of the word and the power of that the word can be used as a weapon, as vile as anything around, but it also can be used to indicate a certain kind of truth and to urge empathy and compassion. This is just so important now where we're seeing so much happening in the States here, but then about the rest of the world too, people sort of fleeing into a kind of a self-centered nationalism and then reassuring themselves of mythologies that never did them any good anyway to hang on to, how you start wars, etc. And language does that when used so badly. He was proof you could use language for a much greater sense of the good.
Well, Peter, thank you for that thought, which I think is a great place to end this conversation. I wish we had more time, but let me get my two guests to just comment briefly on Peter's final statement. Rabbi Pollack, the idea of the power of the word, and Elie Wiesel was probably in charge of that as well as anybody.
So I'm walking to campus with him from the hotel across the river in Cambridge. We cross the BU Bridge. At the corner of the BU Bridge on the Cambridge side, there's a kind of a small sanctuary for geese. And there are about, 2-3 gaggles of geese there. And we're passing them, and there was some talk of making a subway station there. So the protesters were there with their signs saying that the protesters in favor of the geese were there. And the placards that they had said, help stop the Holocaust of the geese. And Elie Wiesel's look in his eye, when I purposely pointed out that word to him on the placard, was exactly the look you just had when you raised your eyebrows. It was worth 1,000 words, but he was very sensitive to words, of course.
Sure. Susanna Heschel, a final thought from you before we say goodbye.
And that is such a deeply Jewish commandment, in fact, to guard one's tongue, because words create worlds. God created the world through words. And so the language we use can actually convey something quite wonderful, and I hope that we follow Elie Wiesel's example and speak the words that can make this a better world.
All right. Well, that's Susanna Heschel, professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College and Rabbi Emeritus Joseph Pollack of Boston University. Thank you both very much, remembering Elie Wiesel, who died this past Saturday at the age of 87. Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro begin exactly 1 month from today. So let's talk about some New England athletes who will be participating in those summer games. And to help us do that, we're joined by investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe, Shira Springer. Shira, great to see you.
Good to see you.
So let's start with Shalane Flanagan, the marathon runner from Marblehead. Tell us about her prospects in Rio next month.
Well, she's certainly a medal contender. She was actually just in town running the BAA 10K, which finishes on Charles Street, and she set an American record in the 10K, which is quite unusual when a marathon runner is in the high mileage phase of their training. So think 90, 100 miles a week, and she's running shorter distances in American record time. So that seems to indicate that she could come away with perhaps a gold in Rio, and she would be the first American woman to win gold in the marathon since Joan Benoit Samuelson, another New Englander, did it in 1984 in the inaugural women's marathon.
All right, so that's Shalane Flanagan, not the only name. Tell us about Kayla Harrison. She's the defending gold medalist in judo, right?
Yeah, one of my favorites.
Also from Marblehead.
Yes, ironically, yes, and trains in Wakefield at Jimmy Pedro's judo gym. I was actually lucky enough to see Kayla win her gold medal in London in the 78-kilogram weight class. Phenomenal competitor, but more phenomenal is her personal story. She was 16 years old when she revealed that she had been sexually abused by one of her coaches. Mm. And sort of her whole path to Olympic gold and beyond has been to a sort of a rebuke to that abuse, and also she has now used her gold medal win to have a forum in which she can educate people about childhood sexual abuse and also raise money to help victims of childhood sexual abuse. But she is was the first American to win gold in judo in the Olympics, and now she is aiming to become the first two-time gold medal winner, and she will enter the Rio competition ranked number one in the world. Very, very good chances, though her main rival is Brazilian. So we'll see if that is a home field advantage for her main rival or more pressure.
Brazilian obviously will have the hometown crowd on her side there. Okay, one more before I want to talk about some issues down there in Rio. The Newton native and Cambridge resident Gevi Stone, she's a rower. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Gevi actually got out to...
It's Gevi Stone. Sorry about that.
No, and I got out on the water with her on the Charles and watched her practice and was in a launch with her father, Greg, who's her coach. Another local medal contender. She was seventh in the 2012 Olympics, and she has had some performances. She was fourth in the single sculls at the 2015 World Rowing Championships, and she has improved since then. So she is looking to get on the podium in Rio. A real comeback story in some respects. She didn't make the team in 2008, thought about quitting the sport, and went from the bigger boats to the smaller boat to the single scull, and has found her niche there. Another kind of cool fact about Gevi is that both her parents are rowing Olympians, so good genes.
Wow. So it runs in the family.
It does.
And rows in the family.
I was
going
to say, and for a lot of New England Olympians, because Shalane Flanagan's mother was the former world record holder in the women's marathon. So a lot of good New England genes.
So, Shira, I want to ask you about some of the concerns about the coming Olympics. We've heard a lot of talk about concern about the Zika virus. There's the issue of street crime. What are you sort of focused on in terms of the challenges that might show up there in Rio next month?
Personally, I'm a little bit more concerned about the street crime that we're hearing about, the muggings that we hear about. These type of crimes are happening around the venues. There was a group of Spanish sailors that was robbed near the sailing venue. Just recently, a mutilated body washed up on the shore meters from the beach volleyball venue. And on top of that, they had some erosion problems at the beach volleyball venue where they were losing parts of the beach. And so what they decided to do is erect, from what I understand, is a 6-foot sand barrier. And that barrier then became a hiding place for thieves who were mugging tourists as they passed by that sand barrier. So I'm particularly concerned about what seems to be actually a rise in crime. There's already a high crime rate in Rio, but it seems like it's getting higher and higher as the games draw closer and closer.
Well, let's hope that the local organizing officials can take care of that issue. Shira Springer will be there next month. She's an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe, and we'll be checking in with her about the Olympics, hearing directly from Rio from her. So, Shira, we'll look forward to hearing that, and thanks for coming in today.
Should be interesting.
Should be. And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.